Sunday, June 11th. I was up early and downstairs for breakfast, close to 8, coming up with Mary Rockefeller in a small room of the Victorian mansion that she had pointed out to me the night before as the prayer room, where her mother and the family had gathered to read the Bible and pray. And there she was, quietly at a table, a Bible in her hand. I felt awkward and intruding and admiring all at the same time. She is a rare woman, gentle and earnest and so unassuming. Lawrence is very lucky to have found her. We went in to breakfast, and it was hearty and delicious, including blueberry pancakes and, naturally, Vermont maple syrup, hot with melted butter. I thought of Linda's maxim, if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly, and ate as though I were going to spend the day plowing those rocky hills. And then we rode to Plymouth, to the home of President Coolidge, following a swift and rushing stream through a little valley, a part of the watershed that's going to be cleaned up by the project we are celebrating this afternoon. The city of Woodstock has voted a bond issue, which, in collaboration with state and federal funds and planning, will result in some 36 miles of clear and unpolluted and scenic waterways in the years to come. It was so fresh and green, and you could understand how the state of Vermont got its name. Naturally, Green Mountain, Vermont. And I never had thought of it until this trip. Part of its charm to me was that not even Johnson City, Texas, was more rural, more off the beaten path than this little green valley, and we were going to the home of the 30th President of the United States. We arrived about 9:30 in a tiny little hamlet with white clapboard houses and store and post office. It had all gelled in time, and I'm sure it had not grown by 5 citizens in the last 50 years. A crowd of possibly 200, many children, were gathered in front of the Calvin Coolidge homestead, white clapboard with shutters, and a front porch with Victorian turned columns that might have come from the same design on Lyndon's house at Johnson City. It was, in fact, so reminiscent that it went straight to my heart, although I had thought of no parallel before between Lyndon and Calvin Coolidge. John Coolidge, the president's son, dignified, impressive, pleasant, was there to meet us. We went up on the porch, Bill and Joan Hoff and Stu and Lee Udall, the Rockefellers and I, and several of the local people, and there was a brief, pleasant ceremony, John Coolidge presiding, and Stu and Phil Hoff making little speeches, and then my word, no notes, just a natural response to this situation on visiting the home of a president, where the land had made its mark on a man, had molded his devotion to duty, his capacity for hard work, his dislike of ostentation, and his ability to express himself in terse phrases. As I looked out at Nan Robertson, I said, perhaps some of you who have been with us on our trips to Texas may find something reminiscent of my own husband's home there. The two men could not be more different. But there's a link in the backgrounds that was singularly appealing and in the homes. And at the end, I gave the National Park Service plaque designating the Calvin Coolidge homestead as a registered National Historic Landmark, Nash and I placing it, and it was quite heavy, on the cement foundation that had been prepared. Then we went through the house. It is open from April through October and has about 30,000 visitors a year, a surprising number for its remoteness. They give out a detailed and interesting guidebook, but visitors only look into and do not walk through the rooms, and apparently there's no bevy of hostesses. I was interested in the woodshed indoors. Chopping the wood for the kitchen stove had been one of Calvin Coolidge's jobs as a young boy. And indeed, there was little progress between the kitchen stove of his day and of Lyndon's. There was a buggy and a sled for winter in the carriage house, all attached to the main house because of the heavy Vermont winters. And the sparseness, the frugality of the furnishings impressed me, knowing that this was the home of the leading citizen of this little community in that day. There was a kerosene lamp on the table in which Calvin Coolidge took his oath of office, a stereopticon, a horsehair sofa, a yellowed Boston newspaper of 1924 with the headline, "Keep Down Expenses is Coolidge's Exhortation." Stu Udall read one of his campaign promises from the paper, "Waste no time, words, nor public funds, and I was intrigued by the familiar ring of a sentence from one of his political pamphlets, "A man who practices what he preaches, a square deal to all." I told John Coolidge I knew my daughter Linda would love to hear him tell what it was like in his day in the White House. He said, to my surprise, that he had the Secret Service with him then, too. He'd been off in college most of the time, and they had accompanied him there also. I told him how much I liked, and all the tourists liked, the portrait of his mother. And I gave him a picture of me, taken in front of her portrait, to leave at the house. And then, a little past 10, we were driving back over the lovely valley roads to Woodstock, arriving at the First Congregational Church, which might have come off a postcard, so pure and white it was, its slim steeple rising against the green hills at the end of the street. Its bell was made by Paul Revere. So were three others in this little town. And it was here that Lawrence and Mary Rockefeller were married 33 years ago. I sat in the pew with them. One of the most delightful things during this whole visit is the way that they move around town, and they wave and speak to people, calling them by their first names. "Hello there, John. Where's Laura?" And people answer back. The sign out front had said, of the church, "Gathered, May 1773. Building completed, 1808. The music was lovely. I recognized one of our dinner guests from the night before in the choir. There were familiar hymns, Beneath the Cross of Jesus. It was an altogether charming service. And we were out before 12. When I spoke to the minister, he told me that his 8-year-old son had said, 'Why don't we invite Mrs. Johnson home for lunch?' It would be an easy little town to fall in love with. We walked down the street to the Woodstock Historical Association, a typical white clapboard house, green shuttered, lilac bordered, and the curator took us through, showing us that 200-year accumulation of colonial furniture and very much the touch of the Rockefellers, though they would be the last to say it. In the basement, there was a small theater given by her mother for community gatherings, and behind the house, a beautifully landscaped lawn leading down to the river. And there was the man who had done the planning and the work on the landscaping. How typical of the Rockefellers to know him well, to have been a part of planning it as well as paying for it. It was a little past 12 when we went out front for the most picturesque adventure of the day, the ride in the Stanley steamer. Vintage 1911, owned by a young boy who was working his way through college by taking tourists for a drive around Woodstock. In fact, he had a fleet of about 3, he and his brother and their father. But before we walked out of the Woodstock Historical Association, we donned our duster bonnets, buying a dream of a hat with pink roses and a wide brim and pink chiffon that tied under the chin. This was one of Liz's inspired ideas, I'm sure, and each of us had one that was extraordinarily becoming. Mary's so quaint and demure, it seemed to have been made for her, and Lee's perky and saucy. The brass was shiny, the running boards high, and the seats higher, and the horn let off a blast just like a train. No wonder it was steam. The Rockefellers, Udalls, and Hoffs were in the 2 back seats, and Curtis Burden, the driver, and I, in the front where I could see the panel. The speedometer said 0 to 60 miles an hour. Yes, he had driven it that fast, on the highway, but it didn't register unless you went at least 15. To get into the spirit of the day, there were several horse and buggies around the village green, and I flinched as we approached them at a merry clip. A flotilla of 3 Stanley steamers. Curtis eased by without blowing his horn. The horses stood still, and we breathed a sigh of relief. Mary Rockefeller was telling us how, when her mother first got a car, she had asked all the folks who worked for her and the neighboring farmers to come up with their horses to her house and had showed it to them, driving it quietly around to get them used to it. This little village of Woodstock in the foothills of the Green Mountains is built around the village green, which is the unique shape of a battleship, and along the banks of the swift-rushing Ottauquechee River. We went around the village green, past the rambling white clabbered Woodstock Inn, with its long veranda. It looks like the grandfather of all summer resort hotels. Past the Woodstock Historical Society, and the white cupboard, and the D.A.R. House and Museum, both built in 1807. and all the little white steeple churches with their Paul Revere bells, and the town hall where we've been welcomed the afternoon before, and the little circle where the places of business are bright with pink and red petunias, and along elm-bordered streets where the houses range between pre-revolutionary and pre-Civil War. In fact, the population of Woodstock, now 3,000, was also 3,000 at the time of the Civil War. And past the site of the railroad depot, built by Mary Rockefeller's grandfather, Frederick Billings, he'd put the whole little railroad up here when he'd bought his home here about the time of the Civil War. It was he who had built the Northern Pacific Railroad, and for whom Billings, Montana is named. The railroad has long ago ceased to run, and the tracks were finally torn out, but you can still see the embankment as it winds its way along the stream, and the depot has become a part of the recreation center. We stopped at the Woodstock Country Club, another of the many marks of the Lawrence Rockefellers. It has been rebuilt by them within the last few years, and is an attractive modern place, and they know the managers by their first names. And then we drove back to Lawrence and Mary's home, which is called the Mansion, and all along the way people waved, and Lawrence and Mary called back a familiar neighborly greeting. And so ended one of the most colorful rides of my career as First Lady. Whistle stop, rubber raft, bus, and ski lift. And now a Stanley steamer. We freshened up and then walked down for lunch to the home of Mary's sister, Mrs. Ethan Allen Hitchcock. It was an old farmhouse that had been attached to the mansion as the home of the farmer in residence, I'm sure. The foreman, we'd call it. Now Mary's sister and her husband, whose ancestor is indeed Ethan Allen of the Green Mountain Boys, have done it over with that bright-colored, deft touch. Good paintings, a sprinkling of antiques, books. It was a welcoming house. It was a group of about 18 or 20 on the front porch, having Bloody Marys and hors d'oeuvres, looking out across a beautiful meadow to the mountains in the distance. Mrs. Hitchcock took me through her house. There's one especially delightful room called the buttery, which was practically octagonal. I don't know what a buttery is in an old-fashioned New England farmhouse, but now it's been done over as a small sitting room with bright yellow walls and gay chintzes and books, and it says, "Come in and linger." Lunch was buffet, lobster casserole. I would have been lonesome without lobster by this time. And in addition, New England baked beans, and very delicious they were. Once more, I ate without thought of weight. Mr. Hitchcock told me some reminiscences about his ancestor. One delightful one was when George Washington appointed him as regiment head of the Green Mountain Boys, and he wrote in his diary, "I must adopt a strict regimen of diet and exercise to fit myself worthily for this responsibility." Back at the mansion, I had a few minutes' rest, and then had my hair combed out, and was dressed by 3 o'clock, in my yellow Ben Zuckerman, no thought of the coat today with it, because the weather was steaming hot, and great thunderheads rolled up across the mountains, and if we'd been at home, I would have said we'd have a rain in 30 minutes. But it held off for the reception. I walked out under the long gallery that encircles the house, and looked down across the expanse of green that descends to the rushing river, and is bordered by the high, beautiful trees. There were several hundred of the Rockefellers' neighbors, the selectmen of Woodstock and neighboring communities, state officials, conservationists, personal friends. Among them, Dan Kiley, the landscape architect who is working on the mall in Washington, Bill Youngman and his wife, the guests I had met at luncheon and the night before. A beautiful setting, the best of what conservationists are talking about preserving for their grandchildren. Mount Tom rising on our right, the Ottauquechee rushing in front of us between its green-bordered banks and undercovered bridges. Lawrence presided deftly, quickly, delightfully, with his most remarkable brand of crisp, business-like efficiency, something I can only describe as humility, and a sort of a little boy quality of, "Isn't it wonderful all this is happening?" A very engaging man. Bill Hoff made a speech, Stu Udall did. General Cassidy, the head of the Army and Engineers up from Washington, was doing the conservation work in the Ottauquechee Valley. And then I. My speech was twofold, a salute to George Perkins Marsh, whose home this was for so many years, and who is, in fact, a sort of a father of conservation in the United States, writing 100 years ago about a man and nature, the effect of man on his environment, erosion, so many of the things that concern us today. And second, a salute to the present inhabitants of this house. I was very earnest when I described Lawrence Rockefeller as America's leading citizen conservationist today, from the Grand Tetons to the Virgin Islands, and here in Ewer Valley, he has made conservation and recreation his life's work. The real thrust of the speech, it seemed to me, was to applaud local initiative, because here in this watershed, that is what it is taking. The willingness to vote a bond issue, to search out and combine state assistance and federal assistance, and weave them into their own planning, and hopefully, in a couple of decades, to come up with 36 miles of clean, beautiful streams, unpolluted. That will be an invitation for tourists, for recreation, which in a measure it already is, of course. And very importantly, for light science-oriented industries, bringing with them their sizable payrolls as a bulwark for the state's economy. I got through it all right. It was a rather good speech, and at the end, I put on the house, the plaque designating it a national landmark. On the chimney high above was the date, 1806, and close by was a window in colored Tiffany glass of one hand passing a torch to another hand. Lawrence had told me that they liked to think that that was the older generation passing on the torch of learning, culture, conservation, whatever wisdom they had, to the younger generation. Then I went down with Mary, preparing to walk across the lawn and shake hands with as many guests as possible, but suddenly we found ourselves in an impromptu receiving line, which included Lawrence and the governor and Joan, and everyone filed by us, all 500, I believe. And just as the last one passed, the rain began to spatter, and so I went up on the porch to sit down with a couple of reporters and describe to them, at Liz's request, my feelings about this trip. So the reception broke up rather quicker than we had planned, with a brisk shower, which relieved the heat. I never thought of a heat wave in Vermont, but indeed I had been hotter than I had remembered since childhood, so completely has air conditioning taken over in the Southwest. Then I went upstairs, stretched out, had a rub to Betty Chappewicki. What a luxury it is to take her along on this trip. And then dressed in flat-heeled shoes and walked with Mary and Lawrence up the pine-bordered path and across the meadow to the little rustic cottage which had been built by Mary's mother as a sort of retreat, she said, and which now is a guest house and occupied for this weekend by their daughter and son-in-law and month-old baby, who had driven several hundred miles from the school in Connecticut where he is working on a Ph.D. in a Volkswagen, just the three of them, the baby in a little basket like a papoose, the young mother, daughter of all this wealth, padding around in a casual shift, and a big smile, just like any other young mother. I don't know why it should be so continually surprising to me. Perhaps other people look at Lucy and think the same thing. And in a way, we have something quite in common. Lucy has, with grace and honesty, I think, and delightful humor, gotten over the obstacle of being the president's daughter. She and Pat are just another young married couple, absorbed into Austin life now, and I'm sure the Rockefellers have, for many more years, even for generations, had the same sort of problem, and have lived with it with flying colors. This particular daughter has, in a way, turned away from material things. Lawrence told me she seriously considered giving her life to some kind of church work. I think he and Mary must have been relieved when she married the gentle, studious-looking young man, who is incidentally a Catholic, who is pursuing his studies at Wesleyan College. Mary held the baby, who at 4 months has quite a personality, really a pretty baby. We sipped iced tea and looked at the Japanese artworks of Lawrence's father, John D. Rockefeller, that adorned the walls of this cottage. They'd been brought there when the old house that the Rockefellers owned somewhere else was dismantled. Then we walked back through the thick pines and across the meadow to the mansion, dressed for dinner. There were about 16 of us, including Walt Rostow, who is now a house guest, and the Rockefellers had very thoughtfully asked Nash, and of course the Hoffs and the Udalls and the Ethan Allen Hitchcocks and the Bill Youngmans. We had caviar. Never do I remember a trip where I ate so many good things. While I huddled in a corner with Walt and two other guests joined us, and I listened to a resume of the last few days in Washington, what's happening in the Middle East, from which I have been so peculiarly, so happily segregated since Friday morning. I am so grateful that he is with Lyndon, so grateful for his life's blood that he's pouring into this job. But of course, it is for the country, and not for Lyndon particularly, that he is doing it, which makes it all the more worthy. but I can't get over a sense that he has a personal feeling toward us. Elspeth couldn't come with him. She has a strep throat. At dinner, Mary gave a very natural, simple, endearing little grace. My admiration for her grows. And at the end, there was wine and more toasts. Funny, serious. Finally, even I gave one for Lawrence and Mary. And then, having discovered that they have a bowling alley, which is in a little house called the Belvedere, which had been press headquarters, and looks like a Hansel and Gretel house in the wood with gingerbread cutouts, I asked if we might have a bowling game. Stu Udall had been disappearing at odd hours to get a tennis game, and when Walt came, he'd done the same thing. And I wanted to add my bit that this administration, through and through, was all for physical fitness. Beside, on a trip like this, I hunger for exercise. I eat and think and try to give out with response and conversation, and I am drenched, saturated with emotions, scenery, feelings, but I do not get much physical exercise. Yes, indeed, they'd be glad to. Mary found me some of her tennis shoes, and 8 or 10 of us walked up to the Belvedere. We took sides, 4 and 4, and I played a very bad game with a ball far too heavy for me, but enjoyed it immensely. There was an ice cream bar in the place. Even some beer began to flow later. Walt Rostow turned out to be a whiz, just as he is excellent at tennis. And it was, for me, the perfect ending for a marvelous day.